Hi, my name is Marcus, and this is a companion podcast for the CG Jung Help Desk Meetup Group. I host live events on Zoom every 2 weeks about the concepts and ideas of the Swiss psychologist Carl Gustav Jung. Every event, I give a presentation about the Jungian concept, so have fun with this event's topic.
We can now start the event, and I want to welcome you to this very special event with the topic of the misunderstood Jung. And this topic I had in mind for a very long time because it reflects my fear that I had when I started this group. Because I had read a lot, I almost read everything. Basically, I read everything. And most people who join very likely have not read everything, which is not a problem. It's like most people did not invest the time and also the money to do it, which is completely fair. But automatically, people come with certain ideas and concepts already in their head. And likely they have read somewhere something. And because Jung wrote really, really a lot and Jung did not have an easy way to write, there are some things where I would say they're not represented completely accurately. And so my fear in the beginning was really that I do these events, people come and I will always tell them like, no, that's not what Jung meant. No, this was not the idea. You got it wrong and so on. So I did not want to be a boss kill and a joy kill. And this event, I will really try to be that and talk about just things I saw and just as misconceptions. Nobody acts in bad faith, but there's some things that people just picked up somewhere in the concept of Jung. And I want to use the event just to address them all. It's also interesting then to see, okay, what Jung really meant, because in many cases, it's way more complicated. So as I said, Jung wrote a lot. He read a lot, of course, also. And he had a hard writing style. And he says that was intentional. And he says he mostly wanted to write in an academic context. And he wanted to make it so difficult and dry that only those who are really interested would be willing to go the extra mile, to go through the material, to read it, to understand it. And this, of course, means that not so much people have read it. And he found out that while he tried to address the, let's say, academic circles, it was mostly the people of on the streets and the normal people with their everyday lives who were most interested. He said it was pretty ironic. His own crowd of people, they ignored him mostly, but the regular people, they became highly interested and wrote him letters. He wrote a lot of letters. You can also buy thick books full of letters that people wrote to him. And this was only until the end of his life where he really said, okay, I try now to write a book for the layperson, which is the standard introductory book, Man and His Symbols. I can highly recommend it in the beginning. It's written easily. Way easier for him are the seminars to read, but he did not want to have them published. He only wanted to have things published that he has written himself. And those things are in the collected works, these 19 books, which are different collections of books and notes and introductions and everything. And he in general did not want to speak in front of an unprepared audience. So he always tried to keep it a little bit away. He thinks he talked about because he had already the feeling that it's pretty complicated and demanded a lot of the people. So when he gave seminars, there were less open seminars and more for close people, artists, friends, other scientists, students of his. And this was his style. People are very often not aware about the many, many different things he wrote about because he not talked about only psychology, but he approaches a lot of things through psychology. So for him, there's connections that normally people would not make. So he started out with a lot of psychoanalysis and he moved on to describing personalities. Like the MBTI is based on concepts of Jung. And he was really the first one to have a rather complex view on personality and what factors are there in personality. At the same time, he talks a lot about alchemy and he talks about astrology and he talks about really a lot about religion, Eastern and Western religion. He talks about occult things. So this makes it hard to place Jung. He can seem like a mystic, like an esoteric person, like an occultist. But at the same time, he's a diehard psychoanalyst and psychologist and therapist. And I realized this when I do these events, that the crowd of people who come, are often very different based on the topic that I talk about. And there's already kind of pre-selection. Okay, what are people are interested in? So there's a huge crowd who are really interested in astrology. And I had this one time an offline event, and there came this girl, I forgot her name, but she even came with a book, Synchronicity, and she really wanted to talk about astrology from Jung. And it was in the beginning of the event, and we talked around about different topics, and we came automatically to the topic of National Socialism, which is also a topic where Jung really has written a lot about, because he lived exactly through that time. And she listened to it for maybe 2 minutes, and then said, oh yeah, sorry, I have to go. So I have the feeling there's many different groups that are interested in Jung, but for different reasons and different focuses. And very often they do not connect. So the MBTI people stay in their lane and the astrology people stay in their lane. And when I try to do the events and try to bring it all together, this is always my concern. Like, okay, do I lose somebody now because I'm talking about the stars and now I'm talking about National Socialism and now I talk about psychological problem of children. And so there's a huge range of different people with different views and how they approach Jung. And of course, think, okay, there's one compartment or one topic, and this is what Jung is about. And then come all these other things, and it gets more and more complicated. And I think this is one of the reasons why it's hard to talk about Jung, because automatically you reach weird or completely different topics. Additionally to that, there are a lot of people who wrote about Jung and his concepts and ideas. So it's completely in popular culture. It's completely in art. And if you look on YouTube, there are, I don't know, 10 million videos about the different concepts. And these are mostly, as I had to find out, not so high quality. They're kind of right, but they're not completely on point. And it's because there's not the go-to dictionary. Okay, what did Jung mean with certain concepts? I also had a hard time. I had to read some letters or some introduction he gave to a seminar to get certain concepts. And I really had to read everything. That's a really tough thing. You kind of have to read everything to get everything because it's completely distributed. He has a very associative style of writing. So he jumps from topic to topic very easily, and it's hard to see the connection. So the main thing and the most important thing that connects everything about Jung and why he was interested about in all the different topics that I just talked about is that for him, the experience that people have is through their psyche. And that the psyche stands in the center, basically, of the universe, of the experience of the outside world and the inside world. And this is how everything is connected. And this is also how he approaches the things. He talks about religion in a psychological way. He talks about astrology in a psychological way, alchemy in a psychological way. So he does not necessarily say, okay, this is all just 100% true. The stars determine our fate and lead can be made into gold. But rather, the idea is people are interested in that. People have written about that and spent a lot of time with it. So there has to be something there. And for him, this there is always the psyche, because what people experience and what people do stems from that sphere. And for him, the separation between the internal world, the world of psychology, and the external world, the real world outside, is pretty thin, because in the end, all goes through our subjective experience of the world, the life, and everything that we experience. And it's all connected through the psyche. And this is the closest that I can define what holds everything together, what Jung talks about, because there's not an overarching theory. And that makes it also pretty hard to understand. You cannot make a diagram and say, oh, now you get Jung completely. This is in contrast, for example, to Freud. Freud, you can explain in 10 minutes. And if you use 1.5 hours, you can go through all the concepts and you get already pretty good grasp of it. But for Jung, I've been doing this now for 2 years. And every event, I do a pretty comprehensive presentation about specific topics. And afterwards, I remember all the things I left out. So for me, it's also hard to bring structure in it, not to make it too disconnected and too disjointed. But it's more like a network of different ideas and interact with each other than very separate things. You automatically move from one topic to the next. So diagrams, there are some, how Jung structures the psyche. But even those, if you look more into detail, they're all incorrect in some different way. but it's difficult to just write it down or give it a visual representation. And the reason why this is has to do with Jung and how he worked. He saw himself mainly as an empiricist, and the style how he approached the world and the psyche is more like a botanist, he described. So somebody who spends their time with plants. The goal is not to connect all the plants in the world that ever existed and will ever exist, but rather to describe the plants that are already there. And he says what he's doing, he is describing certain psychic meaning coming from the psyche, phenomena and experiences to investigate those. So for him, everything is valid. And that makes him so open to all these outlandish ideas. He even wrote an essay about UFOs for the simple reason that people started to talk a lot about UFOs. So he said there has to be something there. That is something in the psyche that needs to express itself in the phenomena of UFOs. And that's Jung. So there is no border on boundary for him what he is not interested in, as long as human beings are doing it and experiencing it. So he is describing a lot of things and tries to find connections between them. But as I said, it's not an overarching theory that holds everything together or even smaller parts, but it's rather, okay, you have this plant here and you have this plant here and they're similar to this plant. He's describing a lot. And this you have then again in the writing style that makes it hard to read and try, okay, what is he trying to get at? What is the idea? What is the concept behind it? And above that layer of just writing things down that he noticed and investigated, he tries to bring in some concepts to connect the things. So he saw himself really as an empiricist, and he wrote a lot about that he is a scientist. So of course, when you start talking about astrology and ions and alchemy, people say, oh, you're not scientific. But he said he is scientific because he's an empiricist and he's just observing what there is. But he does not directly observe the thing, but rather how humans react to it and why humans do it. He does not legitimize alchemy as a valid pursuit, but he says people have been pursuing it. Why? What are they experiencing? To bring it to Freud, as I said, Freud is easy to explain. Jung is pretty hard to explain. What many people know of Jung is the relationship to Freud, and that very often Jung is characterized as a pupil of Freud, which is not completely true. There were more both scientists already on eye level, but in working in different fields. Jung was a huge fan of Freud, so became close friends, and Jung was supposed to be the successor, but somehow it got established that Jung is just a pupil of Freud. But everything that happened after the relationship pretty much shows that this is not the case, because the things that Jung was really interested in, these bizarre things, the occult things, Freud did not bother with it. He said, oh, it's all complexes. We should ignore it. It's not so good. So when we talk about the psyche and the analytical psychology, the main component is the unconscious. And people who have been following the events and or also the podcast might have noticed something. I've never say subconscious. I always say unconscious. Why? Because Jung also only says unconscious. He never uses subconscious. And even in German, I'm German, we say das Unterbewusste, which is also subconscious. I never noticed it till Jung wrote about it specifically. And he said, people don't like to say just unconscious. They want to say subconscious because it places them higher than that. Oh, there's something in below. There's something that is, let's say, not so important. It's not of such a high quality. And he said, that's not completely true. This is rather people trying to discount something that is having a too big influence on them and something they're too afraid of by saying it is the subconscious. It's only the lower, the primitive, the archaic is. But he said our future and our development, it's also all coming from the unconscious. So everything that we will be in the future is already starting there, like a seed in the ground that's unfolding over time. So the tree for the seed is unconscious. It has to go there. It has to grow there. It's the future. Same as our unconscious causes also the past when we have complexes and other things, but also our future. So subconscious, unconscious. a misconception that often comes up with the unconscious because Jung talks so much about it, is that he saw this also with his patients, that when you talk about, oh, this is the unconscious, is actually something important and something that has future development and that has value and so on, and also connects us to the past and all the past instinctual knowledge that people have, our human nature, right? That we're already prepared for a lot of things in life. Then it seems to be way smarter than me. Then I only have to listen to my unconscious and everything will be fine. So this is my eternal guide. I just listen to my unconscious. I do what it tells me. And then this is already the best way. I don't have to decide. I don't have to do anything. And he said, no, not really. He encounters it in the sense that his patient said, oh, I don't know what to do or what to think about it. I just wait till a dream tells me. And he said, no, that's not how the relationship between consciousness and unconscious works. As the unconscious, he said, is something out of time. It's something a little bit more eternal. It's human nature, but your human nature is not adapted to the year 2023, but rather to the last 10,000 or millions of years. So it needs consciousness to be in the here and now and also to establish it. Everything coming out of the unconscious is unrefined. It's not really there. It has not unfolded its full potential. It's a synergy between consciousness and unconsciousness, which brings all the good things and the high value things and the sophisticated things. Only consciousness is bad. Only unconsciousness is bad. But both together, that's where the value lies. But this is a common misconception to automatically, when talking about what is all there in the unconscious, like a big treasure trove, to say, oh, this is way worth than myself and everything I am. And I just use that. And I don't have to be anything. And just let the unconscious do the thing. The perception that's also is being raised when talking about Jungian psychology and all the things he talked about is that the unconscious is fun. It's a little bit like an adventure land where you dream and you meet archetypes and you individuate and all looks very nice and all looks very interesting. For him, the unconscious is a force that can potentially overwhelm people and even destroy their consciousness. So for him, psychosis and schizophrenia and so on is the unconscious being so strong that it rips apart consciousness and people can't act anymore. For him and his approach towards the unconscious is always do not seek it out. It will come by itself. And when it comes, you need to find a way to deal with it. It's more like the weather or a wild animal. You have to find a way how to accommodate and survive it. That's also how he treated his patients. He said he's more like a normal doctor. When somebody comes and has their leg broken, it's not the goal of the doctor to say, okay, I will make you now a first-rate runner and you will be the fastest person in the world. It's no. I will try to get you to walk again and that you can work normally and have a normal life. And he approached that also with his patients to say, okay, you have a problem and we're trying to solve it so that you can live your normal life. He said, people don't have to become psychologists just because they went through therapy or encountered the unconscious, or they don't have to spend the whole time there. He even said it's dangerous. He said that for young people, he said, young people should not be in the psyche and in the unconscious, but rather in the outside world, they should establish themselves there. It's only a problem for later in life when all the things that have not been dealt with come up. And this is where he saw his work, to explain people these situations that they encountered. And he also said it about archetypes. He said, do not go out and try to find archetypes. You also don't go out and try to find a wolf. But they come when they come, and otherwise leave them alone. This is also why he does not advise using, we would say, consciousness-enhancing drugs. He was very much against mescaline. So this came up in that time. And he said, this is all unearned wisdom and people should not experience it. And if it's something important that people should know, then the unconscious or the psyche will provide it by itself. It does not need to be forced. And this goes again in this idea of the unconscious wonderland that you can frolic around and have these amazing experiences, a little bit like entertainment, like an amusement park. And he said, no, that people can get lost there forever and can be seriously psychologically harmed. So go in there carefully. He advised even his students who became therapists to say, okay, you need to have such a stable life, family, relationships, everything. You need to be so well prepared in your own psyche that you don't get sucked into the problems of your patients, because it's very easily to get sucked in. When the unconscious is activated in someone, that can also activate your own unconsciousness. And this can then create a dangerous situation. Yeah. So this was always one point where I was afraid to talk about with people, because if we're all here because people are interested in psychology and necessarily in the unconscious, that it's not the same for everyone to handle that and to be also aware of that. So he saw all the things he talked about and what he gave name to. I talked already about archetypes, individuation, all those things. He never saw that as the final word. He saw that only as a metaphor to explain it. He was aware that he could not give complete scientific proof for his concepts. It's more like hints. It's more like, okay, there's something coming up so often. There has to be something to it. And he described it as good and as well as he was able to do. But at the same time, he said, he's feeling like someone on a completely new continent. So it will change over time. There will come next generations and they will cultivate the land and build cities and create all this new culture and so on. But he's, with his psychologists of the past, the very first people on a new continent experiencing those things for the very first time. So very likely things are incomplete or not completely correct. And he was humble in that position. So it should not be put too much emphasis on the terms and words that he's using, but rather the concept and the connection he sees between certain things. All in all, when we talk about dreams together with the concepts he's talking about, Jung had a very symbolic view on things. And this comes in part from his psychoanalytic background, that things should not be taken literally, which is interesting. So do not take things as they seem, but rather as what they really could be. And this is strongly in dream analysis. So you dream of sleeping with your mother or killing your father. That does not really mean that you should do these things, that you want these things. That would be a Freudian approach to saying, oh, this is some kind of wish fulfillment, not directly, but indirectly. So he's very loose with his words. He is not really focused too much on them, but rather saying, okay, these are a necessary stand-in for now to explain something, but in the future, we will have something better. In that sense, I see him similar to Albert Einstein, who also did not really do scientific experiments with his ideas. He came up with the concepts. He thought them through completely. He had this mental training exercises he did, and he said, okay, it seems like light behaves like that, time behaves like that, gravity causes this. And it was rather with time when certain experiments happened and people tried to prove other theories that all the results of those experiments showed that Einstein is correct. And we have satellites now and we have satellite orbital communication and this GPS, which had not been possible without Einstein being correct. But of course, Einstein could not have proven it completely, but rather he did through thought experiments and the things he has written down. And I see Jung as the same way. So maybe we'll come to a point where we can directly measure those things that Jung talked about and prove him in that point. Because it's all very symbolic, and he really looked in it, and he's even said that a meaning life is a symbolic life, meaning that it's hinting to something bigger and that it needs to be unpacked. At the same token, he says, okay, people get interested in psychology, people get interested in dreams. In general, when I do an event about dreams, most people come. You can't do dream analysis by yourself, Jung says, because dreams are outside of your conscious understanding. So it's the unconscious. It's always one step further than you're able to go. It's very close. It's as close as it can get to what you already can understand, but it's right in front of it. And he says he has the same problem. He does not understand his dreams. He needs to elaborate and investigate, and he has to use a pretty complicated procedure just to find out or to extract what is meant with that. And in general, he says, and this is something that's maybe unique to Jungians, what I saw very often, people who are interested in Jung, they are a little bit loners. They sit with their own psychology and are not so, maybe because Jung set such a focus on individuation and personal experience and subjective experience later in life, he tried more to explain, okay, yeah, your psyche is not only in yourself, it's also in the relationship that you have with others. So if you want to develop your psyche, you have to have relationship also with outside people. You can't just sit there and dream and be unconscious and saying, okay, I'm developing now on my individuation path in a higher consciousness. So doing everything alone is not advisable and not the way how he saw how the psyche really develops and what it needs. So I will get now in some really specific concepts. The first one being two terms that he coined. And Jung came up with his concept of personality and structure of personality, of the terms introversion and extroversion. And he even got into problem with Rorschach. I don't know if you're familiar with him. There's this ink block test where you have a white piece of paper and you two ink dots on them. And people then have to describe what they see. And what they see says something about their mental state. Rorschach also had the exact same concepts in mind, but was not fast enough to publish them. So he did not like Jung for the rest of his life. But yeah, Jung talks about these terms, but how they're understood today is completely different of what Jung meant. So, and I notice this when I talk about this. So for him, extroverted people, of course, they're sociable. They're maybe even a little bit more relaxed. They're oriented towards people. And Jung says they're oriented more into the outside world. But at the same time, he says extroverted people are great empiricists. And extroverted people pay attention to details. They might not see the connection between details, but they are focused on details and objects in the outside world. So they're completely invested there. And at the same time, they're pretty blind for their introverted side, their own psychology. And everything they see in the outside world is rather dead. And they have to animate it through their actions. And also when they see things change and move, and also people, the explanation why people are doing something is always related to the circumstances, outside forces acting on the people. And that's why they do things. And he said extroverted people have a problem to see that they have maybe secret plans and hidden intentions that might be hidden from them, and that they're then surprised to find out. And also said, he said extroverted people are not interested in psychology and the unconscious. In contrast, introverted people, very interesting, interested in the inner things, and they're interested in concepts. So this is mostly the point where people then drop out and say, what? And this means that people rather interact with ideas and concepts about things than things directly. That's a characterization about the outside world, that the outside world is way too animated. While the extroverted person thinks the outside world is dead and the person needs to now move things along in the outside world, the introverted tries to shut off of the outside world because everything is animated. Everything moves all the time. And the introverted rather wants to have the constant and find themselves there, while the extroverted needs change constantly. The extroverted also like things to grow, but only things to grow. They only have to be bigger. Being smaller is bad. While the introvert likes things to go big, small, this is then interesting. And the bad side of the introvert is being overcome by passions. That's the unconscious side, so that they're surprised by the outburst of their own passion side and their own emotions, because they are rather controlled more and also interact more impersonally and do not tell what they want to do and why they want to do it. They do not show the progress. They only show the result, while the extroverted person just talks the whole time and has to make his personality known all over the world to everyone. So our understanding today is more, okay, how sociable is somebody and how easygoing is someone? But Jung really saw, okay, these people are experiencing the world completely different and have completely different assumptions about them. And it's a completely different view into the world. It's not only, okay, can I talk to someone that I don't know on the street, but rather, do I see the world in details, or do I see an abstract view of the world in the form of concepts, and I rather interact with the concepts than with the real world? Also, a part of the personality is the feeling function. And it took me some time also to understand it. So you see, it's four cognitive functions with a thinking, feeling, intuition, and sensation. And the feeling function does not mean emotion. And this is very often a point of misconception. For him, feeling is rather something cold and calculated. Calculated in the sense, he says, it's like a spectrum between whether I like something or I don't like something. It's a value judgment. If I experience something and something happens to me, do I like it or don't I like it? And when somebody is very proficient in that, they are fine grains and it can be taken apart like a good argument. I can say, oh, I like this part about this, but I don't like this part about that. And if somebody is not of a feeling type, it's rather, oh, I like it completely or I don't like it at all. I'm completely blinded by if one part I don't like, then I don't like the whole thing. And it's really that. And he calls it a value judgment and he counts it as a rational function. So thinking and feeling are for him rational functions because there's a logic behind them. I don't like something because I think that because, and you can have like a causal chain which explains why you reach a certain conclusion. And so it's clear where a thought or a feeling is coming from. You can investigate, you can go back in time and go forward where something will develop to. So he calls it even the judgmental functions. In contrast to sensation and intuition, which are perceptive functions, who are completely unstructured. Something suddenly appears. From the outside when sensation, from the inside when intuition. So there's not connection between things happening. While feelings happening, there's a connection between them that can be explained. Another famous concept of Jung is shadow. And shadow has really, I saw a lot of misconceptions because the real concept takes so long to explain. So how many people understand shadow is, oh, this is a bad part. So that's the evil part, the devil part. This is where violent thoughts are and aggressiveness and all those things. And it's true. For many people, that's the case. But for Jung, the shadow is always the opposite, the counterbalance and the counterpart of consciousness. So everything you do and are is not everything that you could be. And everything else is in the shadow. For example, when people are of the thinking type, the feeling function is in their shadow. It's always relative. Like a shadow in real life that's moving with the light source, for Jung also the shadow is relative to where consciousness, symbolized by the light, is and stands. So for modern people, it's correct that brutality, aggressiveness, all those very negative things, disagreeable things, are rather in the unconscious and that way in the shadow because society is built around bringing them there. But this also means more than that, as I described. So for Jung, I did the event roughly a month ago about the East and the West. He says, for the West, the East in the shadow side. So deep down in the unconscious of Western people, there's Eastern philosophy, metaphysics, all those things. But for Eastern people, deep in the unconscious, there's a Western philosophy and the Western psychology at play. So it's rather how things stand relative to each other and where you are. So where you are and your consciousness, this illuminates. And everywhere where it hits the wall, there's a shadow behind it. So it does not mean only negative things. Sometimes some people call it also the golden shadow because it's a future potentiality. It's the leaping self of you of the future, and it will come out of there. This goes again in this idea of the unconscious being below you, but also above you at the same time, and you're developing through it. And very often in context of shadow, and of context of the unconscious and especially collective unconscious, we talk about archetypes. And archetypes are very often completely way off how they are described in videos or articles or other things. For Jung, an archetype was really a pattern of behavior. A bird building a nest is an archetype. The salmon swimming back to his breeding ground up the river, that's an archetype. Human beings bonding, finding a partner is also archetypal. Archetype means things that happened so often in the past that they became ingrained in the psychology of the living being. And we would describe it as human nature or evolutionary psychology today. But how most people know an archetype is like a picture. There's the father archetype or the god archetype or the trickster archetype. This is all true. There's something below, but below there's always a pattern of behavior. There's an expression. The expression of the father archetype is symbolized by Zeus, but also by Kronos. So there's a connection between those things. But deep down, there is this archetype, which he said cannot be experienced completely. It cannot be perceived completely. We can only see the products of the thing and have to guess, okay, what it might look like. And in the same term, what I also saw a lot are like numbered archetypes. So, oh, there are 6 archetypes. There are 12 archetypes. Jung never talked about how many archetypes there are. He said they're countless. It's same as instincts. It's very also hard to distinguish one archetype from the next. So yeah, we can talk about the masculine archetype, the feminine archetype, and so on. But if you go deeper, you find more and more. So it becomes more and more complex. It's more like a web. It's more to that in that regard. And yeah, the number thing I saw very often, which was kind of strange. You can count it, but it's in regard to having the image or the archetype, the materialization of the archetype. Anima and animus also come up very often. And it took me also a long time to understand. Just because it's an anima, it does not mean it has to be a woman. So when you take the movie Jaws and you have the great shark, the shark is the anima of Captain Brody. Why? Because it's, again, it's a function. And this is like a red thread to Jung's ideas and concepts. You have the obvious fleshy part, you have the picture or the image or the word, but below there's some kind of concept and idea. And the anima expresses itself rather through a function and things that happen. For example, in dreams. So you have to watch how things behave, not what they're called or how they look like, but rather it is really their characteristics and how they interact with things. So the anima is a representation of the feminine function, of the eros function in man. And for example, a man being anima possessed does not necessarily have to mean that he's really interested in a woman exclusively. But if they have very strong interests that drive them around the world outside, they are obsessed. Like Leonardo DiCaprio loves to play anima possessed people. We're completely focused on one thing. And this is, again, this function idea that then comes up very often. The next thing is individuation. And that I saw also very often that individuation is characterized in certain stages, like the warrior phase or stuff like that. Jung does not talk about it. So I found no clue on there. I guess it comes from later interpretation and other texts from people who modified certain ideas. He saw some stages like, oh, you go through the shadow, do shadow integration, then you hit the anima, then you hit the self. But even there, it's not completely clear. Even with the shadow, you start encountering parts of the anima or parts of the self, because in the end, everything is a self. But it's not describable in a clear path what you should do. But rather, he said, if you want to do individuation and if you want to go onto that path, do the next thing. So you develop in your own way and your psyche will tell you what your own way is. So if you follow that, everything is fine. So there's also makes no sense to copy, for example, the path of Jung and saying, okay, I'll write my own red book now. And said, like, yeah, Jung did not set out to write it. It just happened. Same way how people do things and they start developing in a certain way. And if you do this truthfully and you listen what the unconscious says, then you will automatically arrive at points that are completely unique and yours. And this is then the symbolic life. But at the same time, he says, individuation is becoming an individual to become whole, but also to separate. To separate in part from society and also to separate from unconscious forces like archetypes or emotions. And he said, just because you're individuating does not mean that society has to value what you do. So he saw that in comparison to artists. If you create art, it's for society to judge whether it's good or not. If you bring really something to the table. And similar, it's for individuation. You're removing yourself from society, from the normal flow of life and the normal way how things should be. So you have to compensate for that because you're not really interacting in the great picture of things. You're a little bit outside. So you have to bring something from this very special position and society has to judge whether that's useful or not. So It's not like everybody should individuate. It's the same as not everybody should go into the unconscious. And it's even for society to say whether it's worth doing or not. A little bit like artists. So like if you do something and nobody cares, there's a very high chance it's maybe not so good. And the next topic I talked about also very often, astrology and the occult and all the things, people gravitate towards that. And these people are very, it's very easy to be the buzzkill because Jung meant it again through the psyche. So for him, the stars do not change how we behave and how the things happen. But rather, and that's it's a very interesting idea, the reason why we perceive certain images in the sky in the form of astrology is because there's something in our psyche that wants to manifest itself there. So if there's an influence, it's rather the influence comes from the inside and not from the outside. He's explaining a lot with synchronicity in that regard, which is saying, okay, this is astrology and all those things, they are rather a show. There's, again, the obvious image, the thing you immediately recognize or can see, but below it, there's a stage that is harder to grasp and harder to understand. And early in his life, yes, he was interested in the occult and yes, in mysterious things, but he played a complete mythbuster. He explained all those things through the unconscious. He had this experience where he stayed in the house of a friend and he had suddenly visions of a dead woman laying next to him in his bed. And he told this to his host and he said, oh yeah, I bought this house recently and everybody who sleeps in that room tells me that it's kind of haunted. And Jung investigated it in the village and he found out that somebody died in that room. I think even was murdered. So was it this ghost and the spirit still in the room? Jung's idea was rather that there was still like blood particles in the carpet and in the surroundings. And when people stay there for a longer time, that you start to smell it. But it's the low consciousness is very, very low volume. And it's only when you dream or in a sleepy state, then these things come up. And it's your unconscious communicating something to it because your unconscious realizes this smell of blood or these particles. And then it will manifest in the unconscious as this vision of a dead woman or of a ghost. Same with somnambulists, these not truth tellers, but the mediums. He would say they rather go into an unconscious state and the unconscious forces come out. They're tapping into something there, but they're tapping into their own unconscious and using functions that are in their shadow side instead of really having completely access to ghosts or dead people, different personalities. He did this in the first half of his life. The really strange things he started only later in his life when he talked about synchronicity and tried to explain a lot of things with this acausal principle. He also did not think so highly about people talking about the occult things because he said they're not really explaining it. He saw them similarly like religious people who used some terms to explain something. Similar as physicists, they needed an explanation how light can travel to Earth through space when there is nothing in between. There's no medium really to transport it. And people said, oh, it's the ether. But you have not really explained something because it's just another stand-end word. You explain one thing with another word and you say, oh, this is the end. So this concept is called theosophy, and it's used often in religious context, but it's also, he saw it very often in the spiritual, occult, mystic realm used. And he called it very often bad thinking and not so thorough thinking. He talked about religion. I mentioned it before, but for him, religion has a very specific connotation. So he made a separation between religion and confession. So when you're, for example, a Catholic person, you're baptized in that way and you grew up that way, you have a confession. But if you have religious experiences, this means something overwhelming, impressive, encountering with yourself. So he, again, does not talk directly about God, but rather what people talk about when they talk about God, about the God image. And there's one quote that comes up very often where he's asked whether he believes in God, yes or no. And he says, yes. And his argument for it is because he knows. He's asked whether God is real, and he says, yes, I know. And a lot of people take strife with that because they say, okay, how can he know? And this is, again, how Jung operated, because he was a botanist. He just described things as he saw them, experienced them. And he experienced something where he said, in earlier times, this was described as God. It does not mean that there's an almighty being, but there is something very mighty in the background that is described that way. And this is, again, this really weird way of thinking. But people then, again, focus on the surface part, which is, do you think God is real? And then, yes, I know. But Jung did not really care so much about that. He saw it really, his work is his life. And you see it if you have both in parallel. He was working and living through his own psyche and writing these things down, his individual journey. And he said he would be completely fine if nobody else would be interested in the things he's interested in. But because they're important to him, they don't have to be important to other people. And that's why he's so surprised that there are other people who share these experiences, share these views, and are on board with these ideas. And he says there are some people who just operate that way. The same way as people have a psyche that's similar to Freud or Adler, there are people who have their psyche structured in a similar way to Jung. And he's happy to talk to those people. And that's also why he tried to keep that circle small, to really investigate those things. He did not try to convert the world. He did not try to convince anybody that this is the only valid way to view at the world. And I do the same. I say it's a very interesting way to approach certain things, but it does not mean that everything is necessarily true that way. It's just like an interesting journey to take, intellectual journey or also a personal journey. Yeah. And the last thing I want to say is he saw himself very often misunderstood in the way that when he talks about all these things about the psyche and individuation and dreams and so on, that the initial reaction, and he experienced that very often, is that this is meant as an ought. This is how things ought to be. This is how people ought to behave. This is what people ought to do with their life. And everything that's deviating from that is not correct. There's something wrong with your psyche because you're not experiencing the world in a Jungian sense. And he said, no, this is really just describing. This is a botanist going through the garden and saying what he's seen and not really describing how people should live their life. He's there on the continent describing as good as he can, the best of his intentions and capabilities. And this is why he wrote it all down and left us for us to talk about. So, thank you.
This was this event's topic. Thanks for tuning in. During an event, a discussion part follows after the presentation where all attendees discuss the just presented topic or other Jungian concepts. If you also want to join, find the group on meetup.com. The name of the group is CG Jung Helpdesk. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on the platform of your choice. See you next time.